There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5, and it is Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Friday. And looks like rain back in the mix today and tomorrow. More from Dr. Bill coming up. And yes, I did hear. I mean, I've seen the stuff a week from today. It's not that I'm not excited that we could see a snowflake, but it's just... The cynicism you detect is years of this, and it's, you know, if the forecast was for tomorrow and Dr. Bill was calling for snow, different story. But this is like a big, big maybe. A big maybe for days, and it's a week away. That's all I'm saying. It's not not anti-snow. I'm pro-snow, but it's, you know, I'm just want to point out that it's a... It's a maybe. Okay, it's a maybe. All right, there it is. Actually, you know what? We can talk about, I don't know if he has any writings on the history of snow events in Mobile, but I'd like to welcome on our friend, local historian, author extraordinaire, great all-around guy, author of some of my favorite books, and a guy that gives us time to talk history here on the show, John Sledge, joining us now. Hey, John.
Hey, Sean, I appreciate it. Yes, I do have some snow stories that'd be fun to talk about.
Okay, so with this, because they get the long-range forecast. It started off on the 10-day, John. Now it's on the 7-day, and they're calling for the little icon for a snowflake is in the mix for a week from today. It is. People are already going, what's the deal with the snow? I'm like, I don't know. It's a week away. If it happens, I'll celebrate it. I've heard this story before, and it hadn't come true. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's reminds me of a memoir someone once wrote, a Southerner, and I don't recall much else about it, but the title was It Never Snows, and that really defines life in the Deep South, certainly for children, and you know, you would like to have some snow, but if you're in southern portions of Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, I figured in Mobile it's maybe every 10 years. I was completely charmed a couple of years ago. We had a snow event, and the city, I don't think, got much, but they got a lot, like in Citronelle and places like that. And there was actually a mom that they interviewed on the news, and she, like, threw her kids in the SUV and took them up because she was determined they were going to get to see that snow. And I just thought, what a great mom, you know?
Yeah, I listen, when it's the times it snowed, the few times in my children's lives, we've documented those historically because we have pictures every time there's a kid, there's snow. It's very exciting. Same thing I have, you know, somewhere in my parents' attic of me and snow here. But the history of snow in Mobile it's probably one of the shorter books you could write.
Yeah, you know, actually the climate was colder in the past. There was that little ice age that you've probably heard about that happened in the 17th and 18th. 19th centuries in the northern latitudes, and there are actually records on about 1807 of really hard freezes down near the Tom Bigbee River freezing completely so you could walk across it.
Wow.
I've also read that there were very hard freezes in the 1890s. You know, people had been trying to grow oranges in this area, and the hard freeze totally clobbered any hopes of that. Mobile Bay froze out to the end of the Fairhope Pier, I know, and the city of Fairhope had already been established, and bay boats were locked in ice, so that was a very unusual circumstance. And then again, during the antebellum period, right before the Civil War, there was a very fierce snowstorm downtown, and What was fun about that was a lot of urchins and dockside idlers along the river staged a great big snowball fight along Water Street to celebrate the occasion. So we have had a few standout wintertime events.
Yeah, I'm thinking on bay freezing. Now, it depends on what you call the bay freezing, but during the 80s, you know, saw it happen. I had to break ice to put boats in to go duck hunting in the 80s. Seen Polecat Bay freeze. I've seen Chocolata Bay freeze. And I've seen the north end of the bay freeze. I don't remember how far south it went. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if it was way out in the deeper water. But on the flats in there, I remember that. Yeah. But that would have been 80, maybe 86, something like that, or later.
Yeah, that was a really cold winter. I remember I had the apartments. I lived in Seacliff Apartments there in Daphne. And I actually had a friend who lived in the same complex who was from Canada, and it went down to 3 degrees that night, and the damn north wind was blowing across Mobile Bay, and I remember him saying that was as good as anything in Canada. He was a believer, but fortunately for us, that's a really rare.
I want to talk some history with you. A couple things. Number one, you and I were talking during the news break about a photograph in the new Mobile Bay magazine. What? Tell us about this photograph.
Yeah, it's a photograph during Mardi Gras about 1898, and just over 100 years ago. And it was shot downtown. Bimble Square is right off the margin of the picture. The photographer, I'm convinced, was on the balcony on the south side of Dawson Street, looking to the north up St. Joseph Street. So the RSA Tower and all that would have been to your right. And all the buildings are 2, 3, 4 stories. Lots of them have cast iron balconies. And you can see that the parade is in progress off to the far end of the photograph where there are crowds lining St. Francis Street. But what's fascinating is it sort of shows all the foreground is the people kind of on the margins of the parade, drifting away from it or what they're doing. And there are people just jamming the building balconies. There are children, the little boys in their little Lord Fauntleroy suits, you know, those elaborate suits with the white collars that mothers loved and sons hated in the late 19th century. And there are blacks and whites. There are people in fancy dresses and hats. There are people in plain, you know, women in black shawls and hats. And sitting on curbs, there's litter everywhere. I mean, Mardi Gras was as filthy then as it is now. And there's this little flatbed wagon off to one side, and there are these children crowded around it. And the picture is amazingly detailed. I've really perhaps spent too much time looking at it with a magnifying glass, but I zoomed in on the bed of that wagon, and there's a box of some kind of treats wrapped in paper that somebody's obviously selling, hence the kids' interest in it. And then there's an ad for a men's clothing store on the wall of the building that shows a top hat, and it's just an amazing slice of life. The whole downtown in motion, you can imagine the excitement and the noise, and yet a very fleeting moment, and that photographer just captured it perfectly.
Yeah, it'd be something if it existed, if there was a photograph taken in the same place on Fat Tuesday every year.
Absolutely.
Right? And we could compare, because we have this commonality, and of course this year, different, but we have this commonality of our history with Mardi Gras in this city. Maybe, an event that other cities don't have. You could have the Christmas photo somewhere, Thanksgiving photo, but we have this Mardi Gras thing, and to see how it's the same event going on, but how all the human beings may look different, dress differently, maybe different things, but it'd be really neat to look through that.
You know, I agree, and I remember my dad writing that when he came back from the Pacific at the end of World War II, and he'd been, at the very end, he'd been on occupation duty in China, Peking or Peiping, as they called it then, and he comes back to Mobile, and he just talked about, you know, going to a Mardi Gras parade in Mobile in 1946 or 47, and he hadn't been to one in years, and he was amazed at, people had so much pent-up good cheer because they had canceled Mardi Gras during the war years here, and he was also impressed that compared to China, where there had been a great deal of poverty and a lot of conflict between the communists, the nationalists, and the Japanese who had surrendered, people were much more relaxed in Mobile. They were much more prosperous, better dressed, better fed. It was just a real you know, that made him appreciate the country all the more, and Mardi Gras kind of brought all that together in one place.
You know, talking to Mardi Gras historian Steve Joint, he and I talking about it, and he was, we were talking about what may happen after this, next year or whenever, that pent-up desire you're talking about that your dad had referenced. And he pointed out the number of new crews, I thought it was interesting, that came about post-World War II, that we had not only interest in people going to attend Mardi Gras, more groups, more crews formed. Like it was maybe a baby boom of Mardi Gras crews.
Good point, because I think certainly in the 19th century there were, you know, less than five, really, for many, many years. And then there was just this explosion. There continue to be new ones. I counted recently, was it last year, we had something like 40 parades, mm-hmm. and that was just in Mobile. You know, in the old days, there might have been one or two, and Mardi Gras Day was the big deal. But now it's at least 2 weeks, and of course the social calendar goes much longer than that.
For sure. All right, we're going to run to the break, and if you can hold on to the news break, I'm going to come back, because a story, you mentioned a little bit of this to us in the past, but if people can read more about this in the new Mobile Bay magazine, but the Bunker Hill in miniature. Bunker Hill down here? Wait a second. What's he talking about? What is he talking about? So John Sledge will fill us in on the details when we come back. It's Midday Mobile. Our guest, local historian, author, extraordinaire. Great guy, John Sledge. Be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. Midday Mobile, FM Talk 106.5, streaming online, fmtalk1065.com. Remember, while you're there, you can check show schedules. You can get online opinion poll questions. You can get the top three stories each day. You also get podcasts aplenty, 54 hours a week in live local programming we're producing right here at FM Talk 106.5 is waiting for you, just like this conversation we're having with my friend John Sledge. And you can get this and share it as well. And by the way, John, before we get into the Bunker Hill in miniature, I look at the text line and we get these questions. I mention always that you're author of some of my favorite books, and I'm always torn of saying which one I like more than the other. You know, I'm a super fan, super fan of the Mobile River book, but I mean the Gulf of Mexico maritime history, These Rugged Days. I've got people asking how they can get your books. So how can they?
No, I greatly appreciate that, Sean. Amazon is easy. Haunted Bookshop, downtown Mobile, Page and Pallet, in Fairhope, Mobile Bay Magazine, in Mobile. You can get it, call them, or get it on their website. Or you can just Google the titles and get it any number of different websites, but it's not hard to find.
And before we wrap up, I want to talk about the book you're working on now. But before then, this is something you mentioned. You and I were in a conversation. I forget what it was even, but you brought this up, and I said, oh, wait, John, you got to tell me more about that. And you said, okay, well, I'm going to be writing more about it going forward. And now the headline here, the title, Bunker Hill in Miniature, what's this all about?
Yeah, the Revolutionary War on the Gulf Coast is really underappreciated by most people. We think of it as, you know, Minutemen and Redcoats and New England and Lexington and Concord, but there was a lot of fighting on the Gulf Coast. It just wasn't, it didn't fit sort of the people's idea of Minutemen and, you know, patriots and the British. On the Gulf, this was primarily British and Spanish territory, so there weren't many Americans here. And Galvez was the governor of Spanish Louisiana, and he actually conquered what was then British West Florida, which included us. He conquered Mobile, he conquered Pensacola, he kicked the British out of Florida, and also enabled the French fleet to be freed up to fight the British at Yorktown and ultimately help win the war. So there were a lot of incidents. You know, Fort Charlotte, which was in downtown Mobile, was besieged by the Spanish when the British held that. And then afterwards, the Spanish began preparing to attack Pensacola, which was the capital of British West Florida. And so this little incident I wrote about, called The Village, took place in what's now Baldwin County, up there roughly where Spanish Fort is, where I-10 crosses into Baldwin County going toward Florida. and that was technically Spanish territory too. But the British were eyeing it. They wanted revenge because Mobile had fallen. So the British general in Pensacola, a guy named Campbell, was planning an attack against the village, because from the village, and that was just really a loose collection of old French cattle farms. It was cattle country, agriculture. It wasn't a city or a town much. But he could take advantage of the cattle to feed his troops, and then he could use it as a jump-off point to attack Mobile and take it back to the British. So the Spanish considered the village a very strategic site and actually built a little fort, earthwork with a wooden palisade around it, put about 200 troops there. The troops were a mix of black troops, white troops, mixed race troops, some from New Orleans, some from Havana, and they garrisoned this fort and were ready when the British launched their attack in January of 1781.
Yeah, John, you talk about what it was like here, how international, of course, it was here. And so you're talking about who was there defending the fort, but then you've got British regular, you got the Hessians, right? The mercenaries out of Germany working with the British, right?
The British weren't strictly British. I mean, they had maybe 100, 200 regulars, what we'd call redcoats, but then they had Hessians, or Waldeckers, as they were called, because that was the province in Germany that they were from, and they were commanded by a guy named Colonel Hank Sladen, and there were about 60 of them. And then there were also loyalists, or what would be called Tories, people from Maryland, Americans, and Pennsylvania. And among them was a 17-year-old man named William Augustus Bowles. He actually claimed to be an Indian and joined with the Creeks, of whom there were several hundred with this group. Bowles was incredibly handsome, incredibly gifted at self-promotion. So he typically would be in the middle of anything that was going on the Gulf Coast in the 18th century. But this diverse and polyglot group marched over from Pensacola to attack the village, which in that day was no mean feat. You didn't just jump on I-10. They had to hack their way through swamps and bogs and, you know, rains, and it was very arduous going, but they managed, after all that, to achieve a surprise attack and catch the Spanish unawares on an early, foggy, wintry morning, such as we commonly still have. And then it became a very brisk fight for about 2 hours right there at the head of the bay.
Yeah, and we have just a minute here. If you could hold on, because I want to get into you mentioned the head of the bay. This wasn't just a land battle, right? We had, of course, like any good battle in our neck of the woods, we had ships involved in it as well. And we'll come back more with John Sledge. You can, of course, read this story in Mobile Bay magazine. This is from the January 21st. You can check that out there. And then, like Eric and others have asked here on the books, John told you where you get the books, or I can put you a link up on the social media platforms. You can grab it right there. All right, going to get the news, and then Dr. Bill's with no snow discussion forecast at this point. And then we'll come back. More Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5, online at fmtalk1065.com. And I guess we should mention also Twitter at FM Talk 106.5 and FM Talk 106.5 on Instagram. You can find us there as well. Although we don't, Dalton, we got to get a picture or something to put up there. Yeah, picture John Sledge. We'll do that. Put that up there. All right. Be right back.
John Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 1:35, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Friday. Glad y'all are here. And just a note here. I've been saying this for the month of January into February because I'm trying to help you. All right, so this segment of the show brought to you by my buddy Trey with 1-800-GOT-JUNK. If you made that New Year's resolution to get organized, there at the office or the house or out in the shop or the bar, wherever, you're going to get organized in 2021. Here's your pro trip. Here's the pro tip. The pro tip is easier to get organized with fewer things. How about that for a hot take? So if you got junk in your way, it's harder to get organized. Fewer things, easier to organize. Listen, whatever kind of junk. It could be in your house, outside your house. I mean, like trampolines, swing sets, storage buildings. He takes those too, let alone stuff inside your house or your office or a storage unit you pay every month on and you don't need any of that stuff. Get on the phone. Call 1-800-GOT-JUNK or go online and call or go online and make an appointment with 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. And here's how they do the appointment thing too. They realize like you got a life. Right, you got a job, you got kids, you got all these things going on. So this whole idea of we'll be there sometime between Tuesday and Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., they don't do that. They get on with you and they say, okay, what day works for you? And they find a day and a window of time that works for you. And that's when they show up. They quote you a price on the spot. If you say yes, they get to work right then, get the junk gone. So if there's stuff that's in your way that you're tripping over or that's filling up a room that has no purpose, 1-800-GOT-JUNK. Get it done. Get that appointment set today. Maybe get them to come out next week. 1-800-GOT-JUNK online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. All right. Continue our conversation with John Sledge. And this is Bunker Hill in miniature right here in our backyard. So the year again, when is this happening? What year?
1781.
And we have British redcoats and others marching on basically what's Spanish Fort now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Yeah, so
what happens is you know, it's dawn and it's foggy, and the British come, you know, drifting through the mist. And the Spanish garrison, they have men in the ditch outside as a picket line, and they have men in the fort, in the palisade, with a couple of small cannons. And then they have the Black Havana militia are camped out beyond the edge. So when the British started coming through the Havana militia, they didn't even realize what was happening. And then all of a sudden, the lead British troops are in the ditch at the palisade, completely unexpected, total surprise. And the Spaniards who are in the ditch think that these troops, they can't tell what color uniform they have. They think they're the Havana militia coming into the stockade for breakfast. Then all of a sudden, the British start shooting and bayoneting them. And,
oh, wow.
And then they're under attack. And the British are, like, at the palisade. But then what happens is the Spanish sergeant inside the fort is very alert and manages to mount a competent defense, and they start returning fire, and the cannons start banging away, and black powder smoke mixes with the fog, and it's, you know, a sulfurous nightmare. And in the gloaming, the flashes of the muskets and guns are going off bright orange and yellow, and, of course, the old black powder weapons created an incredible amount of smoke. In fact, old-timers called them smoke wagons. And so the British are milling around in this ditch, and they automatically, the Captain Hanks Laden gets killed, his adjutant, a couple of other high-ranking British officers. So the men are without leadership. They start, they're confused, and they're milling around. And one British soldier said, you know, for about 10 minutes, there was just a sheet of flame, you know, within 3 feet of our faces as the Spanish were firing away. And he said, you know, we lost 10 officers. Right off the bat, he said it was Bunker Hill in miniature, which I thought was a beautiful analogy. And the Indians went around the rear of the stockade to try to get in behind it. You mentioned ships. The British had brought a fleet into Mobile Bay, a couple of ships, which had slipped in, was supposed to provide naval support, but it's too shallow, so they couldn't get all the way up there. And they had to anchor too far away to provide any meaningful help. And so here's, you know, William Augustus Bowles hiding behind a tree, firing away into the stockade, the Spanish firing out, British soldiers tumbling down in the ditch, and then finally the British have to break it off. They have to retreat. They're not going to be able to overthrow the garrison. And what's interesting, yet another key character, is the retreat is led by a guy named Philip Key, who's an American Tory, a loyalist fighting for the British. He's the uncle of Francis Scott Key of Star Spangled Banner fame. At that time, Francis Scott Key is, you know, a year and a half old, and his uncle's, you know, practically a teenager, and he's leading the British out of this mess they've gotten into. So the British successfully retreat. the Spanish successfully hold. The total casualties are maybe 40 or 50 wounded on each side and about a dozen or so killed. So compared to the big Revolutionary War battles up in the Northeast, it was a skirmish. But certainly for the men involved, it was intense, it was frightening, and strategically it set the stage for Mobile to remain in Spanish hands and enabled Galvez to launch a strike back at Pensacola that spring and finally throw it over.
You know, I think, John, about Pensacola, and for and maybe it's because it's Seville Quarter, whatever, the time that Pensacola was held by Spanish versus the time it was held by the British, who has the advantage?
Yeah, the Spanish found Pensacola about 1698. There's a brief war between the Spanish and the French in about 1718. Bienville actually comes over and conquers Pensacola for a period of just months and then hands it back when peace is declared. And the Spanish hold it all the way up until the British acquire it after the War of the Seven Years' War, in the Treaty of Paris in 1763. So it's more or less Spanish from 1698 to 1763, almost a century. The British hold it 1763 to 1781 when Galvez kicks them out. Then the Spanish are there until the 1820s when Andrew Jackson comes in and kicks them out. And then, of course, Florida doesn't become a state until 1845, but it's an American territory before that. So it had a long, you know, Pensacola, and you can tell it by the street names and the architecture, comparing Mobile and New Orleans and Pensacola. Pensacola really didn't have a significant French period the way that Mobile did.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I mean, so close together, right? But what international power decided to hold this one and hold that one influences the flavor of the city still today, Pensacola versus Mobile.
Absolutely. Whereas New Orleans didn't have a British period the way Mobile did, the way Pensacola did. Certainly the way Savannah did. You know, we're always comparing ourselves to New Orleans, Pensacola, Savannah, Charleston. Charleston and Savannah are very English, very British. You go there today, you don't get any sense of a Latin vibe, which is what I love about the Gulf Coast, is that you do have more of a diverse mix of cultures.
And if I remember this correctly, before we wrap up, you say, you know, thinking about Jackson and kicking him out of Pensacola, that they didn't exactly put up a big fight, did they?
No, they didn't. You know, the Spanish were so weak.
That's what I was saying. They gave up. They gave up, didn't they? They just kind
of
said, okay.
And, of course, what Jackson did was illegal and brazen, and that was Jackson. he hated the Spanish. But, you know, you had people like Aaron Burr, and this could be another show, who were scheming to take Mobile, Pensacola, Mexico, set it up as a separate empire, break it away from the United States. So it was all because Spain was really too weak to amount much of a defense on, you know, it was just the remnant of its empire.
Which is wild to think about how dominant they were for so long, and then you see this period when the United States is rising, and this the old lion can't fight back. I mean, because the idea, just reading that here comes Jackson into, you know, Spanish controlled Pensacola, you think they're gonna get punched hard, but they don't.
Yeah, well, there's a lesson there, you know, or should be, because Spain got incredible wealth out of the Gulf Basin, out of Mexico and South America, the silver, the gold, all of that. And they squandered all of it in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries in these senseless European wars. And then they were, you know, ripe for the plucking for the rising young power, which was the United States.
Watch this segue as we finish up. There's a lot of that discussion. I'm sure people can pick up a copy and read it this weekend of the Gulf of Mexico and Maritime History.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's where you say, and that's right, Sean, they can get it?
No, I'm just sorry to be so slow on the uptake. Yes, they can get it at Page and Pallet in Fairhope, Haunted Bookshop, downtown Mobile. Haunted Bookshop will even do a delivery if you call them, or you can get it on Amazon.
Excellent. And can we, as we wrap up here, tease what you're working on right now, what will be the forthcoming book from John Sledge?
You know, I appreciate it. I'm actually working on a book about Mobile and Havana and their centuries-long linkages and associations going back to really the founding of both cities. Havana's founded in 1518, 19, and that's when Mobile Bay is discovered by the Spanish.
And there's the statues thing that we've talked about in the past. People realize there's statues looking at each other, right?
Yeah, exactly. Iberville, who was one of our French founders, is looking to the south from the Mobile River and to the north from the Malecón there on Havana across the Florida Strait. So a very key and interesting linkage.
I am looking forward to that book. John, as always, we appreciate your time, and we'll talk again very soon.
Thank you so much, Sean.
There he is, our buddy John Sledge, local historian. Of course, you can go check out his books. You can hear him speak when things get back to where we can go to events and hear people speak in person. And truly a font of Mobile history, and always a pleasure to talk with John. All right. By the way, a couple notes here coming up. Let's see. Dalton, is there – there's a football game, right? Is that – okay. Is there any kind of bet? Did you – there – like I can – completely feel uninspired by this game. I don't have anybody. Is there a bet? Did y'all bet anything on the game? Are y'all just as we wrap here, is there I mean, who do you pull for? Do you have some kind of Tennessee player playing for somebody that
No, not really. I don't have a favorite necessarily playing the game, but at this point I just feel it's Tom Brady, man. He's
And listen to this. So Dalton said this the other day with me. It's just Tom has played in how many of the 50? How many Super Bowls?
So there's been 55 Super Bowls, okay, between the AFC and NFC. Before then, it was the NFL Championship, and then they merged. But technically, 55 Super Bowls, and this will be Tom Brady's 10th that he's played in, and he's looking for a 7th ring. Already holds the record with 6 rings. That's one more than anyone else. And you know, with this storyline, Patrick Mahomes, he might be the best in the game, the Chiefs quarterback, but there's plenty of time for him to win. This is all about Brady right now, and I think the storyline is just too good. They're going to end up winning the Super Bowl this weekend.
There we go. So that's if you're right or wrong, you'll be beating your chest or eating crow on Monday.
Exactly.
All right. Y'all check that out, too, not just on the morning show, but on Sports Night on Monday evening. All right. Be right back. News is next.